Country Breakfast on RN. I'm Edwina Farley. As consumers demand eggs that aren't cage-laid, the industry is having to consider multiple ways of producing enough to meet demand.
There needs to be a premium because the costs are higher to do this. As I was saying to you before, there's more, a lot more feed consumed by these birds. There will be a slightly higher mortality than for a cage shed. And you do lose eggs that are laid on the floor or just broken by other birds, which doesn't happen as much in a cage system.
It's the consumer debate that just won't go away. We'll talk a bit more about eggs later in the program, but Brett Worthington has a wrap of the big stories in rural news this week. And Brett, probably the biggest of them all, involved the dairy industry and milk processor Murray Goulburn.
That's right, Edwina. There was a bit of warning late last week when Murray Goulburn went into a trading halt of shares, and it said it was doing a review of the business. So everyone was closely watching Wednesday. And then the news came out that the price of the milk that they were paying farmers was going to drop 10%. And then beyond that, the managing director and the chief financial officer were both going to be stepping aside from their jobs. This is Australia's largest dairy processor, and it is, of course, Murray Goulburn, as you were saying. What the board was saying initially was, where they've reviewed what's going and they needed a new look to head forward into the future. The chairman, Philip Tracy, says the co-op was going to introduce some support packages to boost prices in the short term, but it was something that farmers would have to ultimately pay back in the long run.
It's a package that will help hold cash distributions to farmers to $5.47 to minimise the impact this year. They will be impacted by a 13 cents a kg milk solids drop in cash flow this year, but the final result will be spread over the next 3 years, recouped from the milk pools in those years.
Because, of course, it's not just something that you can tweak and everything changes overnight. There's a lot of planning that goes into a dairy business, and farmers would have banked on that particular return, you know, turning up in their bottom line. So what are some of the other factors that have contributed to this?
So you've seen a lot of this talk happening on global markets for quite some time now. You've seen the EU drop quotas, and so that's seen milk flood onto markets where Europeans might not have typically been competing. At the same time you've seen Russia bring in import quotas, which has seen cheese from places like Finland competing against Australian products because they just have nowhere to send it to otherwise. New Zealand has been cutting the price that they're paying their farmers. You're seeing forecasts of people leaving the sector over there. Fonterra is the big dairy giant in New Zealand, and while it's been cutting prices over there, it hasn't been cutting prices in Australia. So for some people, they've been sitting back waiting, going, well, when will Australia react to what you're seeing on global markets? Despite all that talk, though, it has left dairy farmers here in Australia questioning their future. Shareholder and supplier Andrew Wilson is from Northern Victoria, and he says that he will have to lay off staff and work the farm by himself if he wants to keep dairying.
If we're not making money and we're working 7 days a week, I hardly see a valid reason to stay dairying just because.
This is just a common sentiment right across parts of Northern Victoria. Andrew Lay says that he thinks you will see an exit of people from the industry.
I think we'll lose a lot of the Northern Victorian dairy farmers. We'll lose a lot more now. We'll have to really, really tighten our belts, and we're going to have to do it even again. I don't know how tight you can go. The future of our family farmers in jeopardy, I suppose.
Paul Mundy is also a shareholder and a supplier. He's from Cobram East. And now he says that the managing director and the chief financial's resignations aren't enough. He says the board has to go.
Yeah, they're either complicit or ignorant of whatever the situation is that has truly got it to this level. I would have thought that our chairman is on somewhere around $250,000. Absolutely, I think they are accountable and responsible and have to fall on their sword.
And of course, you throw into that mix the fact that water is so expensive at the moment. You know, we're all still waiting for that season break, and it's a very important time in dairy farming at the moment. And of course, we're going to hear new prices. Well, they can come out any time from now, but most of those are announced by other companies in June. So from an analyst kind of perspective, and you've talked a little bit, Brett, about that floating on the ASX of Murray Goulburn last year, what's the reaction from a sort of shareholder investor perspective?
So that one. Why the that attracted so much attention is a lot of people supply to Murray Goulburn because they like that it's a co-op. And so when it partially floated on the stock exchange last year, it raised $500 million from investors as part of that float. Leading into this decision on Wednesday, there was a trading halt on shares. When the trade resumed, you saw a 40% reduction almost immediately in the value of the shares. It wiped away about $190 million from their value. Ian McCauley is a former chairman of Murray Goulburn. He's been a vocal critic of the co-op's public float, which happened last year. But despite all that, he's still urging farmers to stick with the processor.
The cooperative will still remain the driving force for milk price. And the more people that can support it, the better off the milk price will be. And that's a big challenge, but I'm hopeful that people will see it that way, and if they possibly can, stay with Murray Goulburn and stay with the dairy industry.
One of the complexities with all this is that the milk pricing structure is so complex. What it is that when you get a price throughout the season, they're saying that's what they expect will be the price they'll pay right up until the end of the financial year. When you see a step back, it's a retrospective cut in what the price is. So that's why a lot of these farmers are adjusting, saying we were planning on getting X number of dollars for our milk for the remainder of this year. There was some speculation that you'd see a lot of the other processors step in and use Murray Goulburn as a cover to then also lower their prices. We haven't seen that yet, although Fonterra is urging its Australian suppliers to, and I quote, budget cautiously. They're saying they're still talking with people. So there is some speculation out there that there could be further cuts from other processors between now and the end of this season. The profit forecast for the company is now half what it earlier was. Belinda Moore is a stock market analyst with Morgans, and she says, look, there was a reason to be optimistic when the company floated last year. There was expectation that prices would rise. That hasn't happened, but she expects that this could well be the bottom of the cycle for prices.
You know, it is Australia's largest dairy producer. The Devondale brand is very strong throughout Australia and Asia. You know, we do think the stock has been oversold. It's trading at a material discount to its asset value. However, in the short term, while the CEO and CFO have gone, there is management uncertainty.
And that's going to be an evolving story, no doubt, with those comments about dissatisfaction with the role of the board as a whole. The other big story around this week was the Federal Labor Party weighing into the discussions about land clearing, which sort of, you know, really in recent months and years have been very much a state issue, now likely to become part of the federal election discussion.
That's right. It was bubbling away and it really escalated in these last couple of weeks. The Federal Labor Party is saying that if elected, it would use the full power of the federal parliament to reinstate restrictions on land clearing. It was all part of the opposition laying out their climate change policies ahead of the election. And part of that was that they're going to see a reintroduction of emissions trading scheme. The Shadow Environment Minister, Mark Butler, says Labor will crack down on land clearing in Queensland and New South Wales.
We will legislate to restore the restrictions that were in place before Campbell Newman's vandalism. We know the Palaszczuk government has been trying to do that in the Queensland Parliament. We will use the Commonwealth's powers to do that, and also to prevent Mike Baird unpicking Bob Carr's reforms.
Wow. So what sort of a firecracker did that throw into the mix?
No, unsurprisingly, Barnaby Joyce had a few things to say. He's the Deputy Prime Minister and the Agriculture Minister. He slammed the proposal, saying it would be inherently unfair and an overreach of the Commonwealth. He says that land clearing really should be a matter for the states.
We are having the discussion at a state parliamentary level. Now they're saying, well, we don't care what the state parliament says. He's saying, you don't know best. Mark Butler knows best. Mark Butler knows best what farmers need. And what Mark Butler and the Labor Party, and no doubt their Green counterparts and their Independent and Allied counterparts want, is they want a new law.
So in terms of a federal or national approach to land clearing, how, you know, what sort of impact could that have, and is it even feasible?
I think the typical players have all kind of had their normal say on where things could go with this. One of the interesting things came from a Western Queensland environmentalist, and he was suggesting that the federal opposition's climate policy fails to recognise ecosystem diversity across Australia. Grazier Peter Whipp says a national approach to tree clearing would be bad for the environment.
I think we really need legislation that recognises the differences across the state. You know, it's very hard even within a state to get the rules that are, you know, going to suit, the rainforest and then suit the grasslands and open woodlands of Western Queensland. If federal government come in with a, you know, just a blanket approach, I think that's bad for everyone, and I think it'll be bad for the environment.
Farmers are smiling somewhere, however, and perhaps they're planting canola.
It's an interesting one with canola because you've seen a bit of a global reduction in the amount of canola that's being planted, particularly in countries like Canada. Europe's also approaching 13-year lows. The forecast is with you've got that lack of supply coming on that prices could kick up, which is obviously good news for grain growers. Avant Agri economist Malcolm Bartholomaeus says Australian farmers could capitalise on these prices later in the year.
Away from the cereals, from wheat and barley, and we are seeing the same here in Australia, and you'll see the same in most countries as they respond to relatively low wheat prices and to the relatively high prices that we've been seeing for oil seeds and pulses.
It was music to the ears of WA farmer Baxter Bothy. He says good summer rains have got his canola off to a promising start.
So our canola looks pretty special at the moment. We went out and bought some longer seasons so that we could start earlier, which we've done. And right at this moment, it's about your sock height or a bit more. It's fully covered. You can't see the ground anymore. So, yes, look, it looks sensational at the moment.
A lot of eyes are on the grain crop at the moment, Edwina. A lot of Victorians won't be sowing canola this year because it's a crop that does require quite a lot of moisture in the soil early
yes,
in the start of season.
Come on, autumn break.
Yeah. It's just It's not coming at all. And I think that's why you're seeing farmers opt out of it, because it requires so much soil moisture. They'll look at other, like a pulse crop potentially, to plant in there and hope that that might fare better. But look, the general state of global grain markets is all in flux at the moment. You've seen a huge oversupply of grain. It's actually meaning that old crop from previous seasons, which farmers might have on their farm, they're unable to sell it at the moment because the prices are quite low and there's just not much demand for it at all. It's something that AWB portfolio manager Charlie Brown says is quite rare to be happening this into April.
Look, the great thing about agricultural markets is they always work in cycles. And so, yes, we might be at low prices today, but the cyclical effect would tell you that at some stage soon we'll certainly be in a better situation.
We also saw Anzac Day come and go this week. And for many in the grains industry, that's the traditional start time for when you start sowing crops. But this year, some growers in Victoria had a bit of a head start. At Underbull in the Victorian Mallee, mixed farmer Andrew Willsmore, he's actually almost halfway through sowing. And he says that's because he had such dry conditions, he wanted to get a jump on it sooner than expected.
We've still got about 600 or 700 lambs, which we'll have to lock up shortly. And there's just no feed. And, of course, everything's lambing at the minute. And, yeah, they're really feeling it more than, well, the cereal bloke's going to hurt as well. But, you know, you always live in hope for sure. So it'll rain.
So it's quite a common theme right across Victoria. You're seeing people are ahead of where they would typically be. That obviously plays a risk with what happens later in the season. But I think a lot of people are just keen to get their crop in the ground. More globally on grain, if it's something you're interested in, Bloomberg's Business Week put out a great piece this week about how America is losing out to Russia in the global wheat market. You're seeing Russia now be the big player on wheat markets. They expect that will have a huge impact going forward. Why that's happening in the States is that you're seeing wheat become less competitive because of the stronger dollar. So you're seeing US now fall to the third largest exporter behind Russia and Canada. That's as US farmers look to go into soybeans and corn more. It's well worth reading and well worth checking out if you're interested.
Yeah, you know, you can take the boy out of Horsham, but Brett, I can still hear that rural reporter, grain reporter in you.
I'm just so fascinated by it. It was it's a great, great industry.
It is very interesting. More twists and turns than you can bank on, really. Now, I love this last story. Tell me about this gorgeous sheepdog.
Oh, it just made my smile from ear to ear. It's about this dog in the UK. He's 4 years old. His name's Pero. 380 kilometres and over 12 days, he managed to make his way home. He had been sent to Cumbria in England to live with new owners. He was there for a month, though, and decided he'd had enough. So he broke out while herding sheep and embarked on this journey back to Wales. The farmer and the original owner, Sian James, told the BBC that she was actually shocked when she opened the door and saw an unexpected visitor.
Pero was on the doorstep, excited, jumping all over the place. We were surprised that nobody came to the door if somebody had dropped him off.
They scanned his microchip and there hadn't been scanned, so they figured that unless someone saw him and dropped him off anonymously, it sounds like the little fella made the journey home all by himself.
Isn't that beautiful?
It's just a nice news story in an otherwise bleak week of news.
Thank you, Brett. Oh, we'll end with a smile. All those stories, of course, if you'd like to read more about what's happened with Murray Goulburn this week, or in fact more about the discussion around land clearing, they're online at abc.net.au/rural.
Coming up in the Science Show, Big Bang with the Bryans. Australia's Nobel laureate Brian Schmidt with America's superstar Brian Greene on superstrings, other universes' wormholes and colliding black holes. It's a cosmic romp.
Dark matter is, well, it's interesting because we don't know what it is, but it's pretty boring.
Have we ever seen a wormhole? No. If we did have a wormhole, could we actually travel through it? Probably not.
The Science Show today at midday, here on RN.
You're with RN and A Country Breakfast. Let's join our rural reporters. This week we learn more about the amazing bum-breathing Mary River turtle and pull on the protective gear to check out some outback beehives in Broken Hill. We discover the secret to growing asparagus in a warm climate and try and move on thousands of flying foxes roosting in a park in Katherine. Rangers are using clanging metal bin lids, car horns, even stock whips to try and chase them off.
Yeah, that stirred them up pretty well.
Yeah, it doesn't take a lot to get them to lift off. It's just trying to maintain that consistency so they just start thinking, oh, well, this isn't a good place to roost. We go somewhere else.
Goodness me, what a racket. I'm pretty pleased I'm not living next to that. We'll go batty about flying foxes a bit later. But first up today, let's head out onto the Mary River and try and catch ourselves a turtle or two.
On a misty morning in a corner of the Mary River, Marilyn Connell launches a small blue boat, the turtle Tubby, onto the glassy water. She's looking for the Mary River turtle, a unique species found only in this river in southeast Queensland and the only one of its genus. It's also a cloacal ventilator, or put more simply, it breathes oxygen through its bum. Hello, I'm Callie Buchanan. Along with the lungfish, the Mary River turtle made headlines a few years ago when it helped stop a controversial dam proposal going ahead at nearby Traveston Crossing. Only discovered in 1990, researchers like Marilyn Connell want to learn much more about this intriguing reptile and the significance of the river to its survival.
We're in a deep pool on the bend of the river and just near the confluence of the mouth of Curra Creek.
I think I can spot a turtle.
Oh yeah, in the river. So the Mary's got six different species of turtles, which is the second most in all of Australia, you know. So yeah, why the Mary?
Do we know why the Mary is such a good habitat for turtles?
No idea. But, you know, it's interesting because we get the lungfish as well and the Mary River cod, and they're all, like lungfish, you know, you'll get them. Most of them, unfortunately, are more than metre long. You know, there's not much recruitment for smaller ones. So, you know, this massive, you know, like a fish that's over a metre long in a river is pretty big. And cod, you know, there's records of them at 35 kg. So that's a big fish as well. The Mary River turtle is, we caught one at 8 kilos. We think maybe the heaviest turtle that's been captured in Australia. We're not sure, but at least it's up there.
This is the third time Marilyn has conducted her trapping program on behalf of Tyro Landcare, a not-for-profit group that works in the small rural community to care for the local land and river. She started in April last year, and a second program in July had to be put on hold when one of her turtle cameras photographed a crocodile lurking well outside its normal northern range.
So what we do is check the net by two of us lifting up at the front and then moving all the turtles that we have, woohoo, in here down to the bottom.
In the first year, the program saw more than 35 people join her venture, including some of the farmers whose land takes in the banks of the river. Today, she's joined by Saran Judas from the Bundaberg Mary Regional Group and student Sydney Collett.
Oh, this is my second time assisting Marilyn with the turtle surveys. I love it. For starters, like, it's a real passion of mine. But I really have a lot of respect for Tyro Land Care members and Marilyn in particular with their work that the work they do for endangered species. So yeah, it's always good to come out and help. Also think they do a very important part of that is you know, building knowledge awareness in the community, and Tyro Land Care and Marilyn are excellent at doing that, which is in evidence by how many volunteers, you know, are happy to come and spend their time helping Marilyn out and trying to save the Mary River turtle.
Marilyn's been really great. She's allowed you to be really hands-on with all the turtles, and she's just a wealth of knowledge, both about turtles and plants and just anything environmental-based. And she's been really great to allow me to get hands-on practical experience doing conservation and all of that.
So where do you think you'll use these skills again?
Hopefully in my career. That would be great. That would be the optimal thing, but I'm actually looking into doing something similar to Marilyn, thinking about doing Masters, Mary River and all of that. Her work's got me into into doing that. She's really convinced me that it's a great opportunity, and especially with something so rare and so endangered.
The turtles are captured in nets in several parts of the river, and every morning Marilyn and some volunteers venture out to tag and release them.
Come on, girl. Come on, sweetheart.
That's it. This is what we come for. Female Mary. Little short tail, stumpy tail. Cute. She's probably breeding size, I'd say. I reckon we've never seen her before. So that's, you know, smooth underneath because they swim a lot, very clean. Oh, she's not very pink. So they have a bit of a pink tinge on the back of their legs here. Grey. Nice little eyes and face that's sort of stares at you. So what we do is we just measure the length and the width. We just take measurements, basically. Okay, well, she's in there. Doesn't matter which order. Go width, the widest part. 24.7 centimetres wide. She's got a bit of a dented.
She has got a carapace dint there.
I'll just go
back a bit.
That's it, got it.
What's
that? 31.1.
The banks of the Mary are all privately owned, which means Marilyn can't do her work without the cooperation of landholders. The data she collects will be used to help inform them about the health of the river, which is a critical water source for horticulture, graziers, dairy farmers and cane growers. The team also monitors nesting and eggs, and landholders carry out fox and dog baiting programs to prevent predation.
Tyro Land Care feel like that the river is the lifeblood of our country, you know, and unless we've got a healthy river, you know, the rest of the country really is affected, and the rest of the country, the health of it, affects the health of the river. So it's really the lifeblood, and we felt like that the Mary River turtle could be a flagship for the Mary River and for a good, healthy river. And if we've got a healthy population of that species, so hopefully, you know, the rest of the river will be in reasonable condition that will be suitable for irrigation, town water, cattle, you know, stock and domestic, you know, water supply, which it's used for, as well as the wildlife. So that's why we're focusing on the turtle as one of our key projects, because it's really a flagship for really the health of the whole Mary.
Back in the boat.
Just watch for these.
Yep. Drop this fella. This is what we're looking for.
On this occasion, a check of three of the nets has discovered a number of common crest turtles, three critically endangered white-throated snapping turtles, and two Marys, a male and a female.
Length is 34.8.
They're all noted in the count, which Marilyn hopes will also help educate non-landholders about how to care for the rivers that bring life to the land.
You know, and it's not just Polly Pipe that has washed down the river in a flood that, you know, is difficult for some farmer to control. You can't, you know, there's a certain amount of litter we have to accept, but there's a lot of bags. Yesterday we picked up bait bags, plastic bait bags, that had just been dropped where they were fishing, you know, like, what is the point in that? You know, they're not a riparian landholder. They're probably not necessarily interested in land care, but they have an effect on the river and of course out to the reef as well.
Before we go into the bee yard, we need to get the smoker going. And that's to settle them down a bit. There's a couple of theories. One is that they think there's a bushfire coming, so they go inside and gorge themselves with honey instead of worrying to sting you.
66-year-old Peter Rawlins isn't taking any risks. He doesn't want to be stung by any of the bees that live in the 19 hives he has scattered in his backyard.
And the other theory is that they give off a pheromone, a scent, and that lets them know to attack you. So this helps to calm it that way too, they reckon.
Hello, I'm Cherie von Hirschner. Peter's an avid beekeeper here in Broken Hill in the far west of New South Wales, and he's known for giving away more honey than he sells. I've got my own white bee suit, gauze hat and gloves to find out more about this growing trend of backyard beekeeping. Now, what are you burning inside it?
Started up with a piece of paper and some straw, but generally I like to use hessian or eucalyptus leaves. That's a nice smell and it makes nice cool smoke. So you don't want to burn them. This has got a bellows on it. If you puff too hard, it sort of catches fire. So you just want cool smoke.
Do they normally attack you? Do you normally get stung each time you come out and have a look at the hives?
No, not necessarily. If the weather's wrong or if you've got perfume on or something like that, then that annoys them a bit. The weather's got to be nice. Today's a beautiful day for it, so we won't have any worries today.
So what kind of weather makes them a bit cranky?
Cold weather, windy weather. You know, as the book says, the day that's ideal for them is hot, and they're a lot calmer, but it's not ideal for us. We're in these suits, you know, they're pretty hot. We'll just get the smoker going again.
Oh, yep. Well, the bees are certainly reacting to the smoke there.
Yep, you see them at the front. Now, the ideal thing is not to be in front of them. Whenever you work on the bees, you should be at the rear or at the sides. And if you stand in their flight path, then there's chances are they're going to get upset with you and maybe sting you.
Okay, so you've just opened a slide at the side of this hive, and you can see inside to see what they're doing. How important is it to be able to see in the hive like this?
Yeah, well, normally you have to pull them to bits, as we would with others, and have a good look at them, because you have to check them all the time for diseases and stuff like that. Make sure they're going all right. Make sure the queen's still laying eggs properly. There we are. I'll just bring one out to show you here. Now, that's honey on that, you see?
Yeah, wow. So half that frame is, it looks like it's sort of, the honeycomb is chock-a-block.
Yeah, if you poke your finger in there, you can see that's all honey in there.
All
but,
right.
But this up here has been capped. And what the bees get it to the right consistency, the right sugar level, right water level, and then they cap it over when it's correct, when it's finished and it's ready to harvest.
Where's the worst place that you've got stung?
You don't want to know. No, the face. The face is the worst of the lot. The wife had a photo of me one stage and, you know, I looked like the elephant man. I've got two stings on the face. But that's my own fault for not having the veil on.
Now, do you have any idea how many bees live in your hives?
No, you're only guessing. In the height of summer, a good hive can have up to 80,000. That's a lot of bees.
And how much honey would you get from your 19 hives that you have here in your backyard?
Well, that depends on how strong the hives are. But generally speaking, each frame that you take, one of those frames, probably hold 2 to 3 kilos. So out of this one, you could get 30 kilos out of this one box. As I keep saying, they're very interesting. You know, you've got worker bees and a queen bee and drone bees, and everyone fancies the drone gets it pretty easy. All he does is sit around all his life and do nothing. But in actual fact, he mates with the queen. That's what he's there for only. And when you get a new queen, she goes out on a mating flight, and she can mate with, say, up to 16 or 18 drones in a day. But the only problem is that after they mate, what do they call it? Endophallus, they call it, penis in other words, breaks, pulls out of the male's body, and he dies. But she stores all that sperm for all of her life. She never mates again other than that one day.
Wow. So do you see many dead bees around on the ground here?
Oh, you see plenty. You know, I just look down and say, you've done a good job, mate, you know. Rest in peace.
Broken Hill beekeeper Peter Rawlins with some interesting bee facts for our reporter Cherie von Hirschner. Still to come on Rural Reporter, they're going batty about flying foxes in Katherine in the Northern Territory and picking asparagus in Carnarvon.
Oh, this is electric. This is a 50-volt DC electric car. It's a little Suzuki. It was a three-cylinder, two-stroke, actually. And it's just the right thing for picking up asparagus.
From the road, Chrysanpachyta boston's asparagus crop just looks like a patch of green ferns blowing in the breeze. But every fortnight during the growing season, Chris will cut off these fronds, encouraging the fresh asparagus spears to shoot from the ground. Hello, I'm Eliza Wood. Asparagus is more commonly grown in cooler southern climates. But with some innovation and labour-saving devices like this electric jalopy, this 80-year-old farmer is successfully growing the crop in Carnarvon, halfway up the coast of Western Australia.
I just drive around. It's got no doors or anything. And,
am I safe, Chris?
No. It's very boring being safe in this world.
And the brake doesn't work either, does it?
No brakes, no reverse. But anyhow, it's just a job. See, that's where we're picking now, along there. We pick, you see, from as soon as the southerners stop picking, which is sort of early December, so I'll get it ready end of November. They all stop, so the price goes up, nearly doubles.
Is that by design or by luck that you pick it the off-season for them?
Well, the natural time to pick would be in the spring too, but the price is very low and everybody else can have it then. So, no, we pick when it's very hot. So we pick at 5 a.m.
Can we stop the car here for a minute, yeah, Chris? So how much ground is covered in asparagus on your plantation?
We've got 5 2-hectare blocks. So it's about, well, in acres, it's about 25 acres of asparagus. Some of them we'll cut twice a year, but the one block, which is over the levee bank next to the river, which is this light sandy loamy soil, and it's really good. It's full of worms and they'll bit, and we picked that 3 times last year and got good yield each time.
What's your secret, Chris, to growing good asparagus?
Well, it's growing in the right place geographically, I think. It's a salt-loving plant. Right here where I am, I've got loads of bottom water with water at about 900 parts per million, just within... It would prefer... I'd get a better product if it was 1,500, but anyhow. Carnarvon has a wonderful climate. It has as good a climate as you'll find anywhere in Australia, I think. I pick differently from anybody else that I know of. It's a system that I arrived at because it suits my way. If you're picking once a year, like they do in a temperate climate, Gippsland and Albany and places, you have to pick for a long time to get your yields out of it. And I don't do that. I've known for a long time that the sugar, the bricks in an asparagus plant, go up quickly in the first few days and then they drop off every week as you're picking. Or you'll all know when you eat a fresh pea in a garden, it's got that special taste. And the same thing with asparagus, when you get it fresh and it's pumped up with sugars, and mine's like that, because I only pick for about 2 weeks a full pick, and then I do what I call a mother pick for a week after that, where I let all the other branches grow up. And then I just keep on cutting another 50 rows every week after that, so it's always coming into fresh, which is high in sugars. Agents will come through and they'll say, you know, we buy this asparagus from Peru and Mexico and Gippsland and places, but your stuff comes in and we just can't work out how you get it so sweet.
How do you compete against those imports from Peru? Is it just, you know, trying to keep the quality up?
It's labour costs is one of the biggest things. So what I did a few years ago was to bring in from Italy to sit on DC electric buggies, we call them. A DC motor can go very, very slowly, and of course if you gear it down, you could go just as a crawl, and you've got hands free because you steer and accelerator on your by your feet. Also, if you're a good picker, you just keep going slowly along, and you can grade as you pick and put your top quality into one crate and your seconds into another crate. And that is the situation that I'm trying to get to, where you pick and grade in the paddock in a crate, put it into the cold water, chill it, and then put it into a carton and send it off to the market.
So, Chris, you're talking about maybe retiring. What's the next project going to be?
Oh, my son's got a small tobacco farm on the Atherton Tableland, and he's flying hot air balloons up there. As he starts at 3 a.m, knocks off at 11, he wonders what he'd do the rest of the day, and I said, well, he just goes asparagus, you know. I said, what a good idea. So I'm going to go and help him get started on asparagus growing. Yeah.
I'm John Burke and I'm a wildlife ranger in Katherine. And at the moment we're at a flying fox colony in Pryor Park in Katherine, and we're trying to assist the residents with the management of the flying foxes.
And if you live near Pryor Park in the Northern Territory town of Katherine, I reckon you want this noisy mob moved on before they became too comfy. G'day there, I'm Daniel Fitzgerald. Parks and Wildlife Ranger John Burke and his team are using car horns, banging bin lids, metal fences, and even cracking red stock whip in an attempt to disturb the flying foxes from their roosting trees. They don't want to kill the bats, simply encourage them to move out of town and settle down along the Katherine River, away from populated areas where they can become a public health issue.
There's probably about 2,000 flying foxes in the park and the surrounding area at the moment. The main means of trying to move them on is with the assistance of the residents and using passive noise, the noise disturbance, so they don't stress too much. And if we can be succinct and continuous with that sort of management technique, they tend to get a bit agitated and eventually they'll move on.
Passive noise, what does that mean?
Well, we don't want any large bangs. Over the years, there were different techniques. It was quite the use of pyrotechnic shot, that sort of thing. We don't use that anymore, so it's more subtle, using like metallic sort of banging noises, banging bin lids, and the odd sort of crack of the stock whip or beeping the car horn. So if it annoys us, then it annoys the flying foxes, so we tend to use those sort of noises. Yeah. We'll go for a... Do you want to drive your car through, Joey? And
yeah.
Just give them a beep.
So all this noise that you've been making has lifted quite a few of them off the trees at the moment. They're all circling in a huge big swarm, but they're not all getting out of the trees. Does it take quite a bit of noise for them to get them all out?
Yeah, it's more being consistent and giving them the opportunity to climb to the top of the tree to take off, so they can take off easily. Obviously, as the day progresses, it gets hot, so they don't want to move and we don't want to disturb them then. So while it's cool like this, we'll take the opportunity to try and make it slightly unpleasant for them, and hopefully they'll go and look for somewhere else to camp.
Where exactly are you trying to drive them to?
Preferably for us at the moment, they would move down into the river corridor, and there's plenty of room there for them to roost, and they obviously don't have the same impact on the people around town as they do while they're in the park or in a residential area.
How hard is it to get them to go where you want them to go?
It's quite difficult, and I don't know how successful we'll be in the next few days. Last week we managed to get about 1,000 of them to go down into the river corridor. Unfortunately, a few of those have come back. But even if we halve the colony and some of them go down, it's better than not at all. Yeah.
What do you think has brought them away from the river and here to the residential part of Katherine?
The main reasons we believe they come into town is because there's a number of native and exotic species here, so they've got a lot of shady roosting trees, as well as a lot of exotic plants that are flowering and fruiting, so they've got more or less a food source very close to where they roost, and it's sustainable because of the varieties of tree species that are here flowering and fruiting.
Does it call for a crack of the whip now? Yeah, that stirred them up pretty well.
Yeah, it doesn't take a lot to get them to lift off. It's just trying to maintain that consistency so they just start thinking, oh, well, this isn't a good place to roost. We'll go somewhere else.
From past efforts, how long do you think it'll take to get them to move out permanently?
Yeah, that's a hard one. You don't really know unless you're probably one of the bats hanging in the tree. But, yeah, some days they'll move overnight. And other times we won't have any success at all, or we may reduce the colony size, but we'll end up with a smaller permanent colony here until they choose to leave. So they potentially could be here for 3 or 4 months.
and unfortunately the car horns, whips and clanging metal bin lids haven't worked. The bats are still in residence in Prior Park in Katherine. Let's hope they move on soon, especially if you want a good night's sleep. You're listening to A Country Breakfast. I'm Edwina Farley. We've got another instalment for you from East Timor today, looking at a 16-year-strong Australian aid partnership, which is helping local farmers grow more food more successfully.
Start your day with RN Breakfast with Fran Kelly.
That is from the last time I was on your show, Fran. It's a very dangerous show you have. They're incendiary.
I just asked some questions, Minister.
Then head home with RN Drive with Patricia Karvelas.
It's nothing more than a political stunt.
It seems to be a bit of a my royal commission is better than yours competition between...
But they don't respect royal commissions. It's a political stunt, Patricia.
Bookend your day with RN Breakfast and RN Drive, 6am and PM here on RN.
Well, could barns be the future for the Australian egg industry? After researching alternative laying systems in Europe, a New South Wales egg producer is convinced Australia needs to look at barns as the core method of production if consumers continue to demand cage-free eggs at a reasonable price. Now, under a new national agreement, free-range eggs must come from hens that have meaningful and regular access to an outdoor range, with a stocking density of no more than one hen per square metre. Robert Pfeffer is a Nuffield scholar and a director at his family's Canobolas Eggs, which produces barn-laid and caged eggs. He tells Peter Doherty the trend towards barn production in Europe is driven by a change in thinking about bird welfare.
I've seen that in other parts of the world, they're not as concerned about some of these numbers that we worry about density of this and the space of that. I mean, they still have regulations in Europe, for example, but they're starting to focus much more on the bird welfare outcomes and looking at what the mortality is like, what the feather cover is like on the birds, because a lot of birds, even if their system that they're in is fantastic, if the management of those birds along the way is not really good, they can still end up more naked than a cage bird at the end of their life and with much higher mortality than cages ever see. And that is the reason that chickens originally were taken out of free-range and barn situations. That everybody was a free-range or barn producer in the 1950s, and now we're trying to convert some of those lessons learned back into these alternative systems.
Were there any particular systems that you saw in your travels overseas that you think could potentially work here in Australia?
The fairly intensive barn systems have impressed me more and more the more that I've seen more of them. Initially my impression was, oh, they're a bit like cages. But as I came to see the birds more, I went into more sheds and saw more farms and the way that they were managed, I really see some significant advantages. And I think for the future, that if Australia still want to have the same access to eggs and a reasonable price point for eggs without as many hens in cages, then we need to look at barns as being the core of that production. And that's what has largely happened in Europe, not so much in the UK, but in Europe barn eggs have become the major form of production and free range is more of a luxury item.
Could we take a walk through this barn and could you describe it in a bit more detail?
Yeah, that's fine. They're very confident. They're very used to human interaction, these birds, because we're in here quite a lot. These hens were raised in an aviary rearing system as well, one of the first in Australia that basically matches the conditions in here as with their conditions from virtually from day old.
Can you tell me about the space? There seems to be a lot of free space at the other end of the barn, yet all the hens are gathered around our feet.
Hens are really curious and they like to be where the action is. Some of them like to be too close, so they're the ones that are pecking our boots at the moment. But certainly a lot of them just want to be nearby, watching us, assessing whether we're a threat or whether we're just something that's livening up their day. Just around us here, there are ramps to help the birds to move right from the ground to the top. But some birds will fly straight from the ground all the way to the top. Others are only happy to sort of fly from one level to another.
if you could measure it per hectare, I know we've got three levels, but if we could talk about it in relation to the hens per hectare system, how would this compare?
The interesting thing about the stocking densities is that even in the free range systems, the space inside the shed is the same as what we have here, and can be even higher. So the Australian standard is 30 kilograms per square metre of bird inside, which means approximately 13 adult birds for every metre. Now, those, if they're in a free range system, those birds are free to go outside during the day up to that that stocking density that's talked about of 10,000 birds per hectare, which is one bird per metre. And that reduces the number of birds inside the shed during the day. But then at night, they're back up to that density. In our barns, we've got no more than 9 birds per metre of space at all times. Whether it's the middle of the day or the middle of the night, the birds are stocked no more than 9 birds per metre, which sounds like a lot, but by the time they all sitting on perches or sitting on the floor or roaming around, there's still lots of open spaces. So if this was a cage shed, we would fit twice as many birds in the shed, almost twice as many birds, and that's for the same concrete cost, the same walls and ceilings, and the same structural cost. That's where the alternative systems are much more expensive per bird, and it'll take many more years to pay off a barn or a free-range shed compared to a cage shed, unless you're getting a substantial premium for those eggs.
And do you get a substantial premium for barn-laid eggs?
There needs to be a premium because the costs are higher to do this. As I was saying to you before, there's more, a lot more feed consumed by these birds. There will be a slightly higher mortality than for a cage shed. And you do lose eggs that are laid on the floor or just broken by other birds, which doesn't happen as much in a cage system.
And that's Robert Peffer from Canobolas Eggs in Molong in the New South Wales Central West, ending that story from Peter Doherty. Australia's longest-running agricultural aid project is coming to an end, having lifted East Timor's farmers from the ashes of the militia's destruction 16 years ago. After the UN peacekeepers, Australian agricultural researchers were some of the first on site to assess the damage and what they needed to develop. The work with Timor's farmers and agriculture researchers has reduced the so-called hungry season, almost doubled local production, but still has a way to go with reducing malnutrition. Serena Locke assesses the Seeds of Life project in this special report from East Timor.
At this ceremony, the latest release of new crop varieties to tackle poverty and malnutrition in East Timor, with the Australian ambassador and Timorese agriculture minister. Australian agronomist Rob Williams translates.
So I was explaining that when we choose varieties, it's not just based on yield and production, but we test it with farmers, make sure it tastes proper, it eats well, you can store it, you can keep it.
19 new crop varieties is the culmination of 16 years of work and $38 million of Australian involvement. The Seeds of Life project began in the smouldering remains of the post-referendum violence when pro-Indonesia militia retaliated on Timor's vote for freedom. John Dalton explains Australian agronomists were among the first to work on food security.
And the place, of course, had been wrecked, and, you know, and families and whole groups and communities were totally disrupted and up in the hills, fled, and could see that the varieties, well, one, there was a huge hunger problem, and two, the varieties that farmers were using were very old varieties, and the CGIAR, the World Crop Centres, had much better varieties that could be much more productive. So their first step was, let's go to the CGIAR, ask them what varieties of maize and rice and peanut and sweet potato and cassava, the basic food crops, could they provide us with so that we could do some research and find the best ones for Timor.
With the new crop varieties developed at the international research stations, they needed a way to multiply the seeds. Agronomist Rob Williams explains how Seeds of Life collaborated with other international aid groups.
Some groups and some charities just gave seed away to their farmers and they never knew what happened next.
But one group particularly did really well. What they did was establish seed production groups. And those seed production groups, they would give seed, teach them how to produce seed, give them a way of storing it, of drying it, of threshing it. And at the end of the season, they had more seed than they started with. And that was fantastic. That was a way of multiplying seed in the field with the farmers, the people who really needed it.
That work was pioneered by Budi Kunwa, a leading agronomist from Nepal. He joined the project and became crucial to the success of Seeds of Life.
The plan over the 5 years to make 1,000 groups over the five-year program. I think he hit the target within 3 years, so he did it really, really quickly. And across all species, so he did corn, rice, peanuts, sweet potato and cassava.
So the ministry doesn't have to buy seed in anymore, and they buy from these commercial seed producers. And last year, you know, there was $400,000 that went around these 70 groups. They're now becoming commercial farmers, and that's sparking the whole business of commercialisation of agriculture, which needs to happen once you can get production up, people can move beyond subsistence.
Yeah, we're bumping and crunching our way along the hilltops, surrounded by mist and rain, and hitting a pothole at every corner.
Big change, of course, is that.
We've arrived at the village Fatabloko to meet the village chief.
Another element of Seeds of Life project is mapping the countryside and its watershed. The uncertainty of land ownership is a hangover of the Indonesian occupation, when the military suspected villagers of protecting the Falantil army and marched people out to the cities. The village chief talks about the map markings for farm boundaries, sacred huts and important water sources.
You have to tie up your animals. You can't cut wood arbitrarily. And you can't burn down trees.
So you have to contain your animals so that they don't ruin somebody else's crops.
Okay, yeah.
The Seeds of Life success has led to new banks run locally by the women, as Wayan Tambun explains.
When women have access to get loan, then they can open new business. They produce a lot of cakes, and then they purchase some agricultural products from the rural community and then sell to the local market. They gain a lot of money. For example, in Berilali, I observed that a lot of women more empowered now because of shopping and loans.
Rob Williams says the farmers have been hungry for better information and have embraced the new seed varieties.
Our recent survey shows that about half of Timaru's farmers are growing one or more of Seeds of Life varieties. That's producing about $6 million worth of extra food in the country than would have been done otherwise. So overall, it's a success because it's 60,000 households now are producing an extra $100 of food in each household.
A champion farmer, Francesca Magdalena Pintu, is so happy with the new seeds, she wrote a poem for a visit by then-president Ramos Horta.
Oh, Sele Corn, today you are spreading throughout the whole of East Timor. Your big cobs and your shiny seeds make us farmers in the whole of Timor-Leste very happy. It's helped us in many ways. One is that I can send my children to school. One of them's at university. We've been able to cement the floor of our house, buy a motorbike. We can fulfil our obligations for weddings, funerals and all the associated ceremonies. And we can help family members who need our help.
Champion Timorese farmer Francesca Pintu, ending Serena Locke's report on East Timor and Australia's longest-running agricultural aid program. And Serena travelled to East Timor with the aid of the not-for-profit Crawford Fund. We'll have more from East Timor next week. A big thanks to Nick Mirisch for technical production. I'm Edwina Farley. Thanks for listening. You're with RN.